must be a welcome stayin' poor mortal. Yeah, we'll go to heaven on my flying trapeze, eat all the fruit I please. Gonna drink my fill of that heavenly wine till the judges call my heaven. Sweet wine brings a blush to his cheek. Showed him the way to live forever, longer than anyone. He stole the petals from the dying sun, fresh when the day was done. Stone and monkey, gather your family round, follow some on the
talk over Getachew Casa doing Tezeta Slow from the first volume of the great series of Ethiopiques, Golden Years of Ethiopian Music, 69 to 75. We heard Bert Jansch before that with Mike Nesmith and Red Rhodes and Klaus Voormann all playing with him on 1974's L.A. Turnaround. The song was Stone Monkey. James Elkington before that new record called Pastel de Nada. We heard I Altered. David Grubbs has a new one. It's called Whistle from Above. We heard The Snake on Its Tail. Oksana Lind, Traversius, the name of the record, recorded in the 80s and 90s, just released on Buh. Track was called Arrecif del Espacio. Micah Frank and Chet Doxas, doing the music of Hildegard von Bingen, part one. Track was called Silva Ignis. We heard Oberon, very obscure British folk teen group, doing their version of Nottamon Town from a great new Ace comp called Gather in the Mushrooms, the British Acid Folk Underground, 68 to 74. Erland Apneseth did Song Over Stoves from a record on Hubro of the same name, and David Thomas performing with Rocket from the Tombs, Transfusion, at the top of the set from The Day the Earth Met, Rocket from the Tombs, recorded in 1975. Goodbye, David Thomas. And fare y'all well. Till next week, I look forward to seeing you next Monday at the same time on Freeform Radio, WFMU in East Orange, WMFU in Mount Hope in New York City and Rockland County at 91.9 FM, worldwide online at WFMU.org. Bye.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'll be your host for the next hour or so. So happy you have decided to spend some time listening in. We're talking movies today, and not just any kind of movie. We are talking about dystopian movies, tech dystopian movies. And the reason I wanted to talk about this is because every week I'm coming at you with news, creepy news, disturbing news, shocking news about what big tech and other aspects of the tech industry are doing to all of us, to our society, to our education system, to our economy. And the news is just this unremitting stream of disappointment is probably the nicest way I can put it. And it is just once in a while, it's good to step back and not talk about the actual events, but maybe just talk about from one remove of this dystopia we're in by looking at movies, fictional accounts that filmmakers have put together over the years to explore the possibilities of what could happen. And it's a lighter fare, I'll put it that way, because we're not actually talking about the week's headlines. It actually happened. It's just, you know, what if there was Soylent Green? But there's not. Or actually, there was Soylent. But, you know, at least we can rest easy knowing that there. I'm not going to give away the spoiler for Soylent Green, but the reveal at the end of the movie isn't actually happening yet. And so that makes us feel better. And so there is a nice outcome of watching some of these dystopian movies and knowing that they haven't yet come true fully. And I wanted to explore this by talking about some of the dystopian movies of the past and present. And I thought, who would be a great conversation partner to do this? And one name came up. Actually, many names came up, but that's right. They weren't available. I want to welcome Dan Morfitt to the show. Dan, welcome to Tectonic.
Thank you so much, Mark. Thank you for having me.
I want to say, first of all, I'm so excited to have you on the show. You have a show here on WFMU called WFMU Lite, L-I-T-E, which is Thursday mornings, 3 to 6 a.m. E.T., Eastern Time, or as you say, 3 to 6 Eternal. And Dan, you are someone who I have gotten to know a little bit through your show, and I know that you know a tremendous amount about pop culture and other types of culture, and that includes dystopian movies.
I know lots of little bits about many, many things, but I'm no expert in anything. I'm a terrible Brit in that regard. And, you know, talking about these dystopian movies tonight and the scourge of tech, when it's got fundamentally all this goodness at its disposal, but it does it for ill instead. Have you ever thought, is there a chicken and egg situation with dystopian movies? Because like we saw with Star Trek, we got flip phones because of the communicator, and we got Bluetooth because of Picard's badge. Could we be influencing the dark world in the future because of what dystopian movies are?
Yes, that's a great opening question. Actually, there is a dystopian movie called Enemy of the State, featuring Will Smith as, I don't know if he was a CIA or NSA operative or something, running around Washington, D.C., and they had a drone of some sort watching his every move and tracking him, and it was this aerial surveillance. And this is absolutely true, because I've had people on the show talk about this. They've talked to the people involved in the first American military drones, and they said they were inspired directly by the movie Enemy of the State.
He also had a Neo Geo handheld game unit, which were really expensive back in the day. And of course, Gene Hackman was great in that film as well, sort of playing a sequel to The Conversation, which first alerted people about people getting bugged in their houses by security services and finding out that anything that you said on the telephone could be heard by anyone, for good or bad.
That's right. That was a classic movie of surveillance. We could have done an entire show just on surveillance movies. But to your point, yes, I think movies and TV shows, as you point out about Star Trek, have certainly featured as idea starters for these tech companies and these days the tech bros, to the point where there is this meme. I'm sure you have seen this. It's been passed around on social media a long time about the so-called torment nexus. Someone went on Twitter a couple of years ago and was saying, it's like, this is not an exact quote, but the idea was, it's like the tech bros watched the movie or read the book called Don't Build the Torment Nexus.
Therefore, we should build it.
Exactly. Yeah. They use it as an instruction manual instead of a warning. And a lot of these dystopian movies, I feel like they were trying to issue a warning. And the warning, of course, it always goes unheeded by society at large. But in particular, there's this small group of very wealthy, very influential entrepreneurs who then look to this dystopian. Here's another example. Not exactly a dystopian movie, but if we look at the Lord of the Rings movie series, of course, based on the Tolkien novels, there was this thing called the Palantir, which was basically a crystal ball that was weaponized by the bad guys. Now, Lord of the Rings pedants will say, actually, the Palantir wasn't evil. It was only when Sauron made it evil, it became evil. Whatever. Anyway, in the books, the Palantir was this orb that was used for evil ends. And so when Peter Thiel started his global surveillance company, which is quietly, I think, one of the most influential companies in the world.
It's inveigled in most intelligence networks across the globe. Five Eyes, everything.
And we know now what he decided to call his surveillance company, Palantir. And it's as though these guys, they have no... In fact, I remember when ride-sharing first started, and I saw the name of the company, Uber.
Ubermensch.
maybe that was not my first. I just thought, you know, at that time it was these bros who wanted to take over large land masses, let's say. And I thought, Uber, really? You're going to call it that? Anyway, so what do you think, Dan? Do you see examples of these dystopian movies being used as instruction manuals?
I think so. We've all watched Terminator and then Terminator 2 Judgment Day. There were no other Terminator films after that point. None of them exist because they're terribly, terribly bad. But that should not be used as an example to build a T-800 and send it back in time. Should not be an example for Tesla or Xiaomi in China to build humanoid robots.
And speaking of China, I don't have this in front of me, but if memory serves, I believe China started a space-borne surveillance network, and they called it Skynet.
it's a bit like Reagan in the early 80s when the Star Wars program was invented. It's like, we're going to have these massive lasers in the sky. The beautiful thing about George Lucas's Flash Gordon fighting the Nazis in space is that it's not set in the future. It's set in a galaxy far, far away, a long time ago.
That's right. Let's talk about some of the specific movies that we have. You and I, Dan, have both put together a list of movies that we thought of, perhaps we've seen or we want to see at some point. And I'll start with, let me see. I'm going to start with a recent movie called Megan, spelled M3GAN. Did you ever see that one?
I cannot do horror films. I believe it's mainly a horror because I've seen the trailer where her arms turn into knives. I think she takes apart an old school cutter, like stationary cutter. And yeah, she decapitates. Is it Ronnie Chang?
Well, all right. Well, a lot of spoilers there.
Sorry.
Pretend you didn't hear that if you still want to see Megan. But I would say, Dan, I'm also not a horror fan particularly. But Megan was a movie that I felt like it was almost a send-up of horror movies because you kind of know the premise of this movie, for anyone who hasn't seen it, is that there is this small animatronic doll or robot, if you prefer, that is invented by some Silicon Valley company, and the prototype is available to the boss's family, and the boss allows her daughter, who's, I don't know, 12 or 13, to play with this this little doll called Megan. And Megan seems very sweet and a little bit creepy and is watching her while she sleeps and knows everything about her. And you just, you know, you have this feeling of unease throughout the whole movie, throughout the first act. You know that Megan is not going to turn out right, and indeed she doesn't. So you have this sense that she's probably going to have knives and she's probably there's going to be blood. And there is, but it's not really scary.
Isn't it a cross between The Terminator and the 80s sitcom Small Wonder, where a man had a small animatronic daughter, and he used to change her instructions by flipping a little thing at the back. He'd like did her dress up, and then there was like a panel behind her. Really, really weird. I have seen a trailer for Megan. I think, is it Megan 2 or 2.0? I don't know if they've gone the obvious route.
Yeah, it's something like, I'm not interested in seeing the sequel. It looks like a totally overboiled version of the first. The first one was kind of clever because it's taking this idea of home robots that are becoming sort of popular, and it gave it the Black Mirror, or as you say, the Terminator treatment. Mm. What if it's not everything that it promises to be? What would be funny is if this thing just runs riot through the company itself.
There is something that you just hit on the head as well there. There's not many dystopian films that are worth anything that have sequels.
That's
because
a
dystopian movie in of itself is the end is bleak, the end is bad, the end is wrong. This is what you're going to get if you go down this particular path.
That's a good
and
point.
And not many dystopian movies, if they ever go into sequel territory, they're normally just reruns of the first one with longer car chases, maybe a tie-in with Limp Bizkit or someone doing a song. But there's not many that have sequeled. The one that I think is probably the most sequeled, and I don't know if it's a dystopian movie, but I will call it one, especially now in 2025 America, Back to the Future.
Ah, yes. Well, Back to the Future 2 had a certain character that resembles this other certain character we have in our national life, unfortunately.
And Zemeckis has come on record and said many times it is absolutely 110%
based on him.
The Real Estate Man.
Yes.
And it's amazingly sharp. It's one I remember watching it when I was a kid and loving it. And they talked about sequels. Jaws had multiple sequels in that film. For it to be come true as it is now is phenomenal.
Yeah, I remember when the Cubs finally won the World Series. and the meme was Back to the Future predicts the future again. Somewhat like The Simpsons. I mean, The Simpsons has had a lot of really strange predictions that have come true, including the ascendancy of the current occupant.
Yeah, eerily prescient. But again, with these dystopian movies, if you follow any kind of writing, these things do repeat themselves, just with a slight glitch every single time.
You know, that's a good point to bring up about sequels and dystopian movies, that they don't usually work. The series that comes to my mind is Alien. Which in Alien, the first one, the original, Sigourney Weaver, it's basically a perfect movie.
Perfect.
It's perfect, shot by shot. Aliens, number two.
Cameron.
I loved Aliens.
It's a godfather because the sequel's better than the original, which is ridiculous.
It's so good. And those are the only two movies in the Alien franchise. The others don't exist. And actually, my son went to
see Alien Resurrection?
Ugh. None. Whatever. And I can't keep track of all the names, but there's one that just came out a few months ago. And I read the reviews, and basically the reviews said, just what you said, Dan, this is the first two movies just rehashed.
Retreads. And trying to fill in holes in a mythology that they've invented themselves. So I know Scott went back to the Alien franchise with Prometheus and those films with Michael Fassbender and Guy Pearce, sort of looking at the Weyland-Yutani alliance. But you've already done perfection sometimes,
and
the best movie makers you can't stop them from tinkering. But there's going to be certain films that are going to hold in the annals of time. I know they're already held at the Smithsonian. Alien and Aliens will be there.
Yeah,
the rest of them, like you said, Alien 3 is not a bad film though, if you accept that it's not an alien film. It's a Prison Planet film. It's brilliant in that. I think it's Fincher, Alien 3. So you have to respect things as they come. But never, never, ever respect Terminator Salvation. That is off the list.
I made the mistake of watching the first few minutes of Alien versus Predator.
Oh, it's campy, though. It's brilliantly just campy.
Oh, it's just so... it's campy, but I couldn't watch it. But I did fast forward until I got to the final battle, and it was sort of... I won't give away the spoiler, but it was amusing.
And we won't go there with Xenomorphs and the space jockey and David on Earth. And it's a complicated and brilliant mythology, but just keep it as the first two. I think there's now going to be a cartoon of it.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
There's nothing parents love to show small kids than, you know, the what do they call it, the chest breaker or something of emerging from someone's chest cavity. Here's a dystopian movie that never got a sequel and I think never will. Don't Look Up. Did you ever see that one?
Is this the Adam McKay thing?
With the asteroid coming in and
Leonardo DiCaprio and Jennifer. Can never remember her second name. Lawrence.
Jennifer Lawrence. And it got mixed reviews, and some people thought it was it was all over the place, and some people thought it was too strident in a certain slice of politics. I just enjoyed it in that it was showing our current society today when there is a looming threat, and it could be political or environmental, climate change, or choose your looming threat. We have many on offer today. And people are unable to do anything about it, and half the population is unable even to acknowledge that it exists.
I think the interesting characters in Don't Look Up, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, I think it was Tyler Perry and Cate Blanchett as the TV news anchors. And that struck a chord with me, because Adam McKay did great work on The Big Short, and also the other guys where he explained what Madoff's Ponzi scheme was back in the day. So for him to go all in and out with Don't Look Up was amazing. Although you never put Leonardo DiCaprio wearing a beard. The man does not look good with facial hair.
No, not
it's
so much.
It's not good. But I think the stump of it was the media lets us run with this content. Even though it's the most important thing in the world, it will then get kicked to the side for sports. We've got the baseball scores. Yeah, but we're talking about climate change and now we're talking about this big meteor. No, but sports comes next. We need to know how the Mets did in Colorado.
Right.
It's that ridiculousness. And I think some of the best dystopian films have that news network sensibility in there. I'm thinking of Verhoeven's films mainly, like RoboCop and Starship Troopers.
Oh, the those
media
are on
in
my
that.
List, yeah. Exactly.
The way the media portrayed is sort of as a collaborator of evil, and that all these bad things are happening, but the news organizations just put their hands up and just go, we are merely journalists reporting the news. We have to be fair and balanced, which is the scariest phrase of all.
And for that matter, you could list the Movie Network.
Of course, yeah. Finch.
That's
amazing.
Just classic and has a lot to say about more than the news, but it fits right in with RoboCop and Starship Troopers. In that same, I have a little mini category here where I wrote Precursors of Big Tech and the New Gilded Age. So I've got RoboCop, Starship Troopers, maybe we could throw a network in there, and then Elysium. Did you see Elysium?
Is that the Matt Damon film
done
by the South African guy who did District 13? And
exactly.
Chappie?
And it's
Neil Blomkamp.
It's a very good. It's a and listeners, Dan Morfitt is doing this without any digital device or surveillance technology in front of him. He's using his wet matter, which is quite effective.
He's very, very damp. Very damp.
But Elysium is an action film. There's a floating space station or something where people live lives of luxury, and they have, this is the key plot point, they have excellent healthcare.
It's this gorgeous geostationary orbiting space station of perfection, which I believe the Saudis are now making real, but in
really?
The desert. They're making this mile-long city that is basically Elysium, but just a big stick rather than a loop with artificial gravity in the sky.
Yeah, that's that many miles long skyscraper with green spaces inside and artificial rivers, and it never was going to work out. And already it's showing signs that it's they have
crumbling.
Yes, they've already decreased their plans, and you're just these. It sounds like Ozymandias, you know. Let me go to the desert and build this huge statue, basically to my own power. What do you think is going to happen?
I will not let nature stand in my way because I am more powerful than the planet. The thing with Elysium and many other dystopian movies is they are so telling and knowing at the same time, in that they often put something brilliantly stupid and daft in their title. Elysium is a place where souls go to rest.
Right.
Once you have passed this mortal coil and shifted onto the next.
Yes.
And to call this great utopian place in the sky with perfect healthcare, Elysium is like, yeah, to actually live it, you have to die.
You have to die first, right.
It's perfect.
Now, speaking of idiocy, I wanted to call out Idiocracy. Another one of my headings here is precursors of today's politics.
Absolutely. Mike Judge is a genius behind Beavis and Butthead and Office Space and Silicon Valley. He gets it.
Yes.
But this is the one film where he just lays everything on so thick, it cannot become real. And the fact that a film like Idiocracy has become real and then some is... Yeah. Extremely brilliant.
So here we have this 2006 movie by Mike Judge, as you say, and it opens, and it's just such a ridiculous, I mean, you talk about campy. I mean, we're going to take a normal Joe Blow and put him in a cryogenic freezing chamber, and Maya Rudolph as well, and then something goes wrong, and they wake up, what was it, 50 years in the future or something like that?
I think a little bit more, like 300 or something. Or was it? I remember it came out a couple of years after a Mel Gibson film, which was about him getting stuck in a cryogenic freeze and then coming out. So that was a satire in of itself. Who satirizes Mel Gibson films? And then sticking Luke Wilson in a freezer box is fantastic.
That's right. But it's, even the setup, you're just kind of like, all right, Mike Judge. I mean, it's like Team America. Mm. You know, we're going to take puppets and have them save the world. Did you see Team America?
Of course. Yeah. It's one of my favorite films. My my wife does get very, very annoyed because I watch it every single time. I know every single word.
All right,
Gary, you have to do this. I won't go any more further. But
don't sing the theme song.
No, America, heck yeah.
Heck yeah.
Idiocracy is one of those films where Dax Shepard, for once, is brilliant in it.
Yes.
I know he's a great podcaster now. And I really liked his Chips reboot, which was great.
I like Dax Shepard.
Yeah.
He's been in some good movies.
Yeah.
Wasn't he in Galaxy Quest?
No, that was Sam Rockwell with the mustache.
Sam Rockwell, sorry, with the mustache.
But it doesn't look like Sam Rockwell. It looks like Sam Rockwell after three boxes of Krispy Kremes. it's a fantastic, fantastic film.
So
and Terry Crews is the president.
Yes. So 2006, we're supposed to believe that American politics are going to turn into a reality show. There's going to be a reality show star who occupies the White House and turns our legislative process into a lowest common denominator, cliffhanger every week to see what happens in this ongoing tawdry reality show drama. And also the devastations of climate change combined with the decline in cognitive abilities due to people burying their face too much in addictive screens. Mm. I mean,
everybody's tattooed with a payment system. Every major corporation, Starbucks doesn't sell coffee anymore. It sells sexual favors. It's fantastic. They go to Costco, and it's just wild.
Oh, can I say something about that? There's this one shot of Costco where they are walking outside, and they mount this ridge, and they look off into the distance, and there is this vast plane that is not the Earth. It's all one building.
Yeah.
And it says in the front, Costco. And you look at that in 2006 and say, Mike Judge, you're ridiculous. But then when you drive, if you drive an hour west of New York City into Pennsylvania, you're going to pass these Amazon fulfillment centers that look exactly like that movie from Idiocracy. And you think, okay, all we need is a guy at the front saying, welcome to Costco, I love you, and we'll be there.
And the weird parallel for that to another, one of the best dystopian movies I think there is, and you might or might not agree with me, WALL-E.
Oh, yes, of course.
Is the mega firm in WALL-E, by and large, which again is such a great pun perfect. That they just stick in front of your face. Yes. Fred Willard is both the CEO of By and Large and the president of the United States of America. Right. And you think, oh, it's this little cute robot who looks like Johnny Five from Short Circuit.
Right.
And it's this gorgeous egg who basically is a probe, a drone probe to go down to planet Earth to see if it can sustain life again. But then it is this whole dystopian epic where man has left Earth and become spongiform, skeletonless fatties in the vastness of space. It's wonderful.
They thought they were going to go to the spaceship in Elysium.
Yeah.
And instead, it was the Love Boat times 1,000.
Yeah. You know? And Disney. That's Disney Pixar doing this dystopian movie and selling it to kids, going, look at this cute robot. We want you to buy this toy of a cute little robot. And it's hell.
Right.
That's brilliant.
And there's people in their pods, again, with screens jammed into their faces, not paying attention to anyone or anything around them. And I see that, for starters, on the New York City subway. Mm. And I've heard people say this, too. It's you look around and it's, did you ever see that movie WALL-E? It looks like that scene.
The thing I can't stand about the New York subway, and this proves that dystopian movies sort of then become echoes in our own life. Yeah, the amount of people that just get out of a train, look down at their phone straight away, and stop.
Yes.
It's like, keep moving. Don't stop there. You can check your screen once you have left, once you have broke ground and gone into the sunshine.
Two more steps. Or my favorite is the people who get on the train. There's 10 people behind them waiting to get on. They take one step onto the train. They stop, look at the phone, and now nobody can get on the train. Anyway, well, I can say more complaints about screens and pedestrian traffic in Manhattan.
That reminds me as well of a dystopian movie that I don't think is a dystopian movie, but I think they played it for laughs. And I don't know if I get it completely right. Is it Silver Streak with Gene Wilder, where they are on a bus that is nuclear powered?
I believe Silver Streak was a train.
Oh, train, yeah, that's nuclear powered. That's going across the land. And if you put Silver Streak with Gene Wilder in the same boat as, say, Snowpiercer with Chris Evans and this fantastic Korean epic that shows that the classes of a train become the classes of a society.
Right.
Anything can be a dystopian movie if you can project enough on it or the director wants you to look in that direction.
Yeah, that's a good point. So dystopian movies, so we have a couple of patterns here. One is that dystopian movies are being used as instruction manuals. Mm-hmm. They're unheeded as warnings. And they are projections. I mean, yeah, they're satires. They're projections of our current reality, or in the case of Idiocracy, where Mike Judge could tell the society might go in 20 years, and yet here we are.
And it's the thing with satire, and, you know, we're talking about movies, but it's as old as time, satire. You know, like Swiftian satire, Gulliver's Travels. When has satire really ever changed anything? The last time we saw satire change anything was when paintings showed that everybody was in the grip of addiction to gin, Hogarth, and so mothers wouldn't eat their babies anymore. It's that extreme satire. But with movies now and with any writings, it's like, can we actually change anything? Or are we giving the imbeciles at the very, very margins of society ideas of how to supplant us and put us into new little boxes?
That's a good question. Do they have any effect? I could ask the same thing about independent talk radio shows. Do they have any effect? Because one can wonder. But you mentioned Jonathan Swift.
Mm.
He writes a modest proposal I'm reading this now from Wikipedia, for preventing the children of poor people from becoming a burden to their parents and making them beneficial to the public. And, of course, the suggestion was to eat the poor, which was his satirical suggestion.
And again, we're not going to ruin any Charlton Heston movies here.
That's right. I don't know the history of this. Did Swift's satirical essays like this have any effect?
It did have effects on child labor laws and things like that.
Yeah.
As with most things, as you can probably tell from my accent, I'm not from the United States. And I like the fact that everything that's happening in the world today, Britain probably did it about 300 years ago, and far better, and with absolutely no care in the world for welfare or anything like that. But I do not take that as a burden upon my shoulders. I do not embody the British spirit of colonialism. Well, but yeah, it's it did change things. It did change things. Around Swiftian times, Jonathan Swift, the school movement started to build up, and it took probably about another 60 years until public schools became a greater thing and we started getting kids out of the mines and out of the chimneys. But this is the thing about dystopian movies. How long are we now in movies? When did the French Lumiere brothers, and when did the Barrymore set up in Jersey?
100 years of change.
It's not that long. So every time we talk about dystopian and this can never happen here type of thing, it's already happened many, many times before. And that's the best dystopian movies often take the things from the past that we know was absolutely dastardly and abhorrent and just update it with shiny new corridors on a spaceship, because that's the best way to teach us these things.
That's right. A few months ago, I had Brian Merchant on the show. He's the author of a book called Blood in the Machine, which was his history of the Luddite movement. Fantastic book. He really gets into the roots of the Luddite movement, what their aims were, how they had some small initial, I guess you could call them, successes in changing things, and then it looked like they were crushed. I mean, they were crushed.
I remember the Luddites, didn't some of them throw themselves into, like, weaving machines?
No, what they did was they were frame breakers. They broke the machines.
They broke the genies.
With sledgehammers. Yeah. But they didn't break all the machines as is popularly thought today. They didn't go into just indiscriminately at first. There were a couple of incidents. but at first, they were very discerning about what they went after. They went after the machines that were directly exploiting the workers by turning out mediocre quality product and allowing the factory owners to hire unskilled labor to replace the artisans. Anyway, near the end of the book, Brian Merchant talks about how the Luddite movement was just crushed. The organizers of one of the raids were tried in a very public trial, and I believe they were all executed, and that seemed to be the end of it. But no, they had sown seeds that germinated, and that their work, the Luddites' work, eventually helped lead to the first meaningful labor laws.
But then we got steam power, we got the dark satanic mills. Then we're back to Tolkien, and because The Lord of the Rings was all about the dark satanic mills of the Midlands of the UK, and how people were working for money, and then Smaug was I'm not a big fan of Tolkien, but I think Smaug was basically like the CEO, the local landlord, the mill owner who hoarded all the wealth and gave nothing to the little people.
And then you have the Palantir, which brings
the
us
Palantir
full,
back
full
to
circle.
Surveillance.
Tell me one or two movies, Dan, that you're excited about that listeners may not have seen. Because I'm giving you easy ones like Idiocracy and RoboCop. People have seen those, but you sent me a list of some very thoughtful choices.
Well, looking at Charlton Heston, he has an amazing back catalog of dystopian movies. So Soylent Green, again, we're not going to ruin that for you. But you might not go vegan. The Omega Man, which was one of the first times Matheson's script called I Am Legend, his short story, I Am Legend, became a film.
The Will Smith,
The Will Smith and the Vincent Price film, and I think they're making it again.
Now, did you see the Will Smith film?
I did see the Will Smith
film. Because that's kind of a horror film.
I don't understand how I think he's a one-star general could own a house in
Washington
Square. That doesn't make any sense to me. That's the most crackers thing ever.
No, you're right, except when the zombie invasion started, you should have seen the real estate prices. They cratered. He got it for a song. Look, you got a view onto Washington Square Park. There are some zombies, but just avoid them.
I've actually seen zombies. They live here in Newport, in Jersey City. So there's that. There's Planet of the Apes as well, which is a classic.
Yeah.
I mentioned to a friend the other day that Mark Wahlberg was in a Tim Burton remake of Planet of the Apes. This is before the newer ones with James Franco and John Lithgow and Andy Serkis being a magnificent actor. He deserves all the awards in the world because anyone who puts characterization into a chimp and you want to side with Caesar is fantastic. But Mark Wahlberg also starred in a Heston remake with Tim Burton where Helena Bonham Carter played a monkey. And the end of it is paralleled to Planet of the Apes. Again, I don't want to spoil a Charlton Heston film for you, but they changed the monument that they go to.
Okay.
It suits the beard and top hat. Let's put it that way. So there's those films. I think I do love zombie films because zombie films are very dystopian by their very nature because they are a satire.
But they don't count as horror movies? You'll do zombie movies?
I don't think they count as horror movies at all because, you know, Romero gave us the blueprint with Night of the Living Dead and then he did all the Days of the Dead. You know, Day of the Dead is about consumerism and about these zombies literally going to the one place where they feel safe, the mall.
The mall, right.
And then subsequent movies. And then that sort of reignited the zombie movement with Shaun of the Dead.
Yeah,
Shaun of the Dead is a wonderful film.
Yes, that's a fun one.
And in the end, we use the zombies as slaves, which, again, is, for an Edgar Wright film, that's really very strange.
What did you think of the 28 Days Later series?
I love the way it was shot. I love the idea of the rage monkeys.
But do you that going back to our previous thread about
sequels?
Yeah. 28 Days, 28 Weeks. How did you feel it developed?
When it went to France, I thought that was good because who doesn't want to see Parisian zombies? but I think a lot of those films are, again, very, very political. So 28 Days Later, even to some extent, Shaun of the Dead, is a very, very British take on politics. One of the greatest masters of that satire is someone like Alan Moore.
Okay.
Who used to write for comics, 2000 AD. He was one of the writing teams behind Dredd. Dredd is a wonderful character because he's this character that you sort of want to get behind, but he is an absolute fascist lunatic who brings judgment upon criminals. He's the judge, the jury, and the executioner in a moment, and his sidearm will hand out swift justice. Anything Judge Dredd based, and I know they did the Sylvester Stallone movie with Armand Desant and Rob Schneider back in the day.
Wow.
Not Roy Schneider, Rob Schneider,
Big
aka
difference.
The Stapler.
Yeah.
but then they did the remake, which I think has recently come out that Alex Garland, who was the writer on that, also directed it. He shadow directed it.
Okay.
It's a fantastic movie, but that's all about Thatcher policies, Margaret Thatcher, in the UK, which a lot of the things that are happening across the world right now, Margaret Thatcher did with aplomb in the 1980s and dismantled a United Kingdom and made it disunited. With zombie films as well like that, with Alan Moore, with that, he did V for Vendetta, where people with a Guy Fawkes mask come and haunt this brand new fascist theocracy in the UK. When are we going to see that? And those masks, of course, are now worn by Anonymous.
Yes.
And also Watchmen. He put these Thatcherite policies down, but put it into an American comic book.
Right.
And that brings us back to Ozymandias.
Okay, so you started there with that was a great run there, Dan Morfitt. By the way, if you're just
was it a rant?
It was, I'm going to call it a run. You are listening to Tectonic. My guest today is Dan Morfitt, who is my partner in talking about dystopian movies. And I think you can tell if you've listened this far, I know some of the obvious movies. I've seen most of the obvious movies, but Dan has really done a deep dive on this topic, which is why I wanted to invite him in. So, Dan, you just gave a great run/rant on Charlton, starting with Charlton Heston. Give us another seed and go.
So we've already talked about Paul Verhoeven, a Dutch guy who lived through the World War II.
This is RoboCop's director.
RoboCop's director, Starship Troopers director.
Yeah.
Starship Troopers is a wonderful film to keep revisiting.
Okay.
Because the more you see it, you go, there's a guy called Rico who lives in Buenos Aires, but these grey outfits have the silhouette of a lovely Hugo Boss number from around 1939. So the fascism there is really subtle, unless you've lived through it. And Paul Verhoeven's great for that. A comparison to American filmmakers is the one and only David Cronenberg, who is one of the greatest directors, writers of our time. I don't want him to have to... pass over to the other side for him to be appreciated, because that man has done such great work. He's done remakes that are better than the original, and the film that I'm talking about is The Fly. But that is the emergence of the great thing about The Fly is it's Jeff Goldblum.
Sure.
And to steal from another dystopian movie, Jurassic Park.
Yes.
People thought if they could, they never thought if they should.
If they should, right.
The Fly is that movie. It's that merging of tech and body horror.
And a bad idea. Yes.
And like I say, I don't like horror. The Fly is not horror. It's
body
horror.
But that's kind of Cronenberg's
stock and trade. We wouldn't have The Substance, which was an Oscar-nominated movie from last year with Demi Moore, if we didn't have David Cronenberg first.
Yes.
He was a king of body horror, like with Videodrome. As well, he took on Burroughs, some of his best work with Naked Lunch, and he did a really, really good film that I think you should watch. It stars Jude Law. It's called Existenz.
Oh, I saw that in the theater when it came out.
It was this weird 90s thing of virtual reality being king.
Yes, so there were a bunch of VR films in the early to mid-90s, starting with Lawnmower Man, which I would not recommend.
No.
And Existenz, I saw somewhere in the village at one of the art house cinemas, and I thought, oh, David Cronenberg, and here I am in the village in this small theater and watching this, and it's about VR, which I was sort of interested in. And it is VR, but it's Cronenberg. So there's all sorts of bodily ports and people plugging themselves into things and unplugging and goo coming out of out of the little wounds. And there's a lot of slurping and slopping sounds as they do so.
That tech gets attached to you by an umbilical cord, which in modern day parlance is basically a USB C2C wire, because you can see people carrying them everywhere where they go now.
Yes.
It's a fantastic movie, and I don't think it was appreciated at the time, because there were many, many films of the same oeuvre, which The Matrix was probably as much a part of it. The Matrix is a little bit of a weird film, because nowadays people talk about this red pill and blue pill choice.
Yes.
First used in Total Recall years before by Verhoeven.
Wait, I just watched Total Recall again.
Not the Colin Farrell remake, the slightly...
Yeah, the original with
Sharon
Arnold.
Stone and Michael Ironside.
That's right.
He gets given a choice between the red and the blue pill.
That's right. Now that you say it, why didn't I notice that? That's
it's
true.
Not an original thing from The Matrix.
That's right.
And there are some certain broadcasters that are talking about The Matrix and being red-pilled and blue-pilled.
Yeah.
Looking into this, the Wachowskis... I didn't realize this. They were talking about the red and the blue pill, not because they liked Total Recall, but because they were contemplating their own move to change sex then.
Right, to transition.
At the time, there were some trans drugs that was either a red pill or a blue pill.
No kidding.
And that's the reasoning behind that. But
of course, they had to be aware of the Total Recall scene.
Yeah, and that's the thing. These dystopian movies build on each other.
Yeah.
And they build a sort of an alternate future that exists. And that's I love the thing that The Matrix did in that first film. It's a fantastic film. Keanu Reeves is wonderful in it. But again, the sequels suffer because sequels are bad.
Did The Matrix have sequels? I refuse to acknowledge that.
It even had a fourth film, which you do never, never, ever want to watch.
Can I tell you, I loved The Matrix so much when it came out. I mean, there's a lot of resonance there about the importance of, you know, unplugging and seeing the reality beyond the illusion of digital technology. So I was a big fan. And when they announced the sequel, I thought, you know, please let it be a Back to the Future 2, or let it be an Aliens type of sequel and not a George Lucas, Jar Jar Binks type of prequel, I guess you could say.
They extended the metaphor, they stretched the metaphor, and they broke the metaphor, because then they were looking for Zion, and then Neo was the one, and it all just went a little bit Scooby-Snacks.
Well, Dan, I can't even tell you what happened, because this is a true story. I went there with friends, I was in the theater, and about a half hour in, I realized this movie is a dog. Mm. It's an insult to all Matrix fans. I got up, and I was right at the end of the row, and I had to pass all my friends. Are you okay? No, I'm fine, I'm fine. Enjoy the rest of the movie. Okay, goodbye, goodbye, goodbye. And I left, and I went home. And I told them later, I had such a visceral reaction to that movie, how bad it was. And they had such a great world. That's a movie that you could make a sequel of. You could extend the world building and do different things. And they completely screwed it up. And when Matrix 3 came out, I didn't even bother.
Again, as well, on the Atlantic drift, Americans probably would have seen The Matrix as, you know, this quite powerful sci-fi film. But in the UK, watching it, most of the actors were from Australian soap operas, from like Heartbreak High.
Oh, Hugo Weaving.
Like the woman who was the White Rabbit, the guy who played Mouse, they were all in like minor Australian TV shows. And of
really?
Course, it was shot in Australia. It was one of the first films to take advantage of their tax breaks over there. So it was really weird seeing these people that used to be on Summer Bay in Home and Away, now in The Matrix, and a little small Tibetan child who wasn't Tibetan, but he was Australian, going, "I can bend a spoon." Sort of took you out of the room a bit.
Right.
I can bend a spoon. It's just a little bit weird.
It broke the illusion, you might say.
Yeah, broke the Matrix.
What else do you have for us, Dan Morfitt?
I think looking abroad, things like Battle Royale from Japan.
Oh, I don't know this one.
It's a fantastic film about kids just being more unruly every single day to their parents, giving it back to their teachers, not being respectful. And we know Asian society is based on respect for elders and things. So what they do is they pass the Battle Royale Act, and they put a load of kids on an island to fight to the death.
Oh,
and
no.
This is to show to kids, you must behave or you will be sent to an island to kill each other. It's then, you know, there's been so many different copies of this film now. But it is so.
Well, it sounds like Hunger Games.
It's Hunger Games. It's Bullet Train.
Yeah.
But it's all these like one location,
yeah.
Bottle episode type of things. But it's a wonderful film, and Japan really does come up with the goods with this. It's got the surly PE teacher in it that is also ex-military. It's just a wonderful film, but that is less dystopian, maybe, and more just a threat.
Yeah.
If you keep going the way this happens, kids will be sent to be slaughtered for entertainment. And then that hooks us back to The Running Man.
Yes.
The original Running Man was a brilliant film. It was, again, camp as heck. And they're remaking that now with Edgar Wright, who directed Shaun of the Dead. This is how everything comes full circle.
So it might actually be good then.
It might be good, because I think they're going off the text. And and Glenn Powell's playing the Schwarzenegger role. So that should be very, very interesting.
I rewatched Running Man recently. And, of course, it was based on a Stephen King novel. Mm. He wrote under the pen name Richard Bachman. It was one of the four Bachman books. Another one of the Bachman books, by the way, was called The Long Walk, which was about kids slaughtering each other for a contest. But The Running Man was,
It's that pastiche of 80s American gaudy game shows. And then just putting in chainsaws. And that's just a wonderful mix. It's Carpenter-esque in the way gore is used. And it's more like a Snake Pilsen type of character that Kurt Russell played in the Carpenter films. Carpenter's another fantastic director of dystopian satirical things. With Escape from New York, where Manhattan's turned into a prison island.
Right.
Really? And Escape from LA as well, where they set off bombs in the San Andreas Fault, means that California is drifted off into the ocean.
Of course.
Which is, again, a wonderful thought. And it's just the little tweaks of our reality now And then just dialed up to 11.
I just wanted to put in another plug for Running Man. You were talking earlier about The Matrix and those Australian soap opera stars showing up and breaking the illusion. In The Running Man, you know who the game show host was? It was a guy named Richard Dawson, who, for anyone who grew up in America in the 1980s, would have seen him hosting The Family Feud.
Oh, of course, yeah.
And he was known in real life. I mean, you could watch The Family Feud, and the joke was he was a little bit too affectionate to the female contestants on the show. And just a little, I mean, you wonder, is it an act, or is he a little bit, a little gross?
Handsy,
yes. And here he is. I would love to know the story behind him accepting the role in The Running Man, because it's the public perception of Richard Dawson is his character in The Running Man. He's this gross game show host, and he plays it perfectly.
And that's the best thing about dystopian movies, in that they're often not just a basic send-up, but a mirror upon
what
you see in everyday life.
And
also a projection of what you expect these people to be and what they really are.
And, of course, then we have to give, it's not a movie, but we have to give a reference, of course, to Black Mirror.
Mm.
Speaking of mirrors, which consistently, I mean, it has been a little uneven over the seasons, but pretty consistently has delivered a mirror to our present and our future in the dystopia. And there are episodes like Metalhead with the robot dogs.
The Boston Dynamics dog, yeah.
Yes. And that, I think that came out before I'd have to look at the dates, but I think it came out before the Boston Dynamics dog.
I think we've seen the iterations of the Boston Dynamics dog and all the robots that they've been able to put over courses over the years. I think Charlie Brooker he's known as a misanthrope in the UK. He did a really good series of TV shows. He was a fantastic newspaper writer, and he's also big into computer games, Charlie Brooker. But he understands the heritage. He follows Sterling and Twilight Zone. He understands that.
Yep.
He understands the Outer Limits.
Yep.
In the UK, growing up, me and Charlie Brooker, there's probably about 10 years age difference, but he grew up with Tales of the Unexpected, which were tales of stories by Roald Dahl and Arthur C. Clarke. And even Doctor Who is dystopian TV. You think there's a man traveling around the universe in the box. He's got two hearts, and he keeps visiting planets where things have gone wrong. That is dystopian TV wrapped up in a kids' TV show.
That's right.
For Disney Plus now. So, yeah, Black Mirror now is, I think it's at the vanguard of showing what we have in our houses every single day. And again, it's that hiding in plain sight, your intention with the dystopian satire. The Black Mirror, of course, is either the big screen on your wall or the thing in your hand right now.
Yeah, the surveillance device you're looking at right now. Dan Morfitt, we just have a couple of minutes before Dave Mandel comes in here. Dave Mandel, who's not a vandal, and his show, It's Complicated, is a prog rock show. Let's go to the lightning round.
Yes.
What should people be watching that's available right now?
Going to John Carpenter, watch Starman. It's about an alien who has been cloned and tries to put the human race back on track.
Ah.
Has a child. That is then the effectual Starman. That's a great film. I think any of the Westworld, Michael Crichton.
Okay.
But he managed to make robots in a leisure theme park kill the people, and then he did it with dinosaurs, and then he did ER. And ER is probably the scariest thing of all there, this big Chicago emergency room where people die. I think Logan's Run is a great film to watch. Michael York, Jenny Agutter. It's a society where your palm flashes red when you're 30 and then you're euthanized. But before that, you have a great life of hedonism and hot sex. That's going to get a remake very, very soon.
Is it?
Logan's Run.
Yeah.
Probably with Glenn Powell again. He just seems to be the man of the moment.
Yeah.
And that's a really, really good film that shows the difference between generations. Lots of people talking about the difference between Gen X and millennials and whatever they keep making up this week. That's, again, a dystopian film taken to the nth degree. But I think out of all of this, and I'm with you on this, Mark, watch The Running Man. Watch the original Running Man, because I think it's the first time Schwarzenegger probably did something political that probably set him down that road to become the governator.
Yeah, I would recommend that people take a look at a new documentary called Soundtrack to a Coup d'Etat, which is it's a documentary around the events of the murder of Patrice Lumumba in Congo. And there's a lot of music involved, but there is a secondary thread through the documentary that involves the CIA and surveillance technology. And so it's not what I would call a dystopian film, but there are some elements in the film that touch on some of the elements of the dystopia that we now live in.
And I hope very much so that the CIA are listening to us right now, talking about dystopian movies and seeing what they can purloin for a brand new idea.
Because they're not only listening, Dan, they are feeding our voices into Palantir's AI engine so that soon enough they can auto-generate their own Tectonic episode with our AI avatars.
And
they would say nice things about Peter Thiel.
We could even say, you know, the CIA getting Kubrick to make a movie about sending people into space was all part of the deal as well. But I would never say that out loud, especially on a broadcast platform.
Never. Well, we'll just keep it between the two of us.
Yeah.
Dan Morfitt, thank you so much for being on Tectonic today. Let's do this again sometime because we just scratched the surface, and it's just such a privilege to have you with me.
Thank you so much, Mark. And I'm now going to go and watch Sinners.
All right. Have a great week, Dan. And friends, you are listening to the greatest radio station in the world, WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in New York City and Rockland County at 91.9 FM. I've got some homework for you for next time. I want you to avoid Apple, abandon Amazon, forget Facebook, and whatever you do, get off Google. I want to say thanks to brother Daniel Blumen for putting me on our outro track today. It's called Hey, What About Me? Have a great week, everybody. See you next time.
Isn't this just a cultural battle for the brainstem, and technology is going to turn society into an idiocracy where it's all self-medicating with technology, where our world becomes this, like you said, sugary, sweet, immersive tech Netflix marriage? I mean, I can't even process it.
I kept wondering, hey, what about me?
What is the most important issue confronting the American people?
Loneliness.
There's no question about the answer that I have found in traveling all over this nation.
Loneliness is going to be every country's largest national security threat. Of society and then fracking them for profit.
Oh my God.
It's not that technology is an existential threat, it's the worst of society is an existential threat, and technology is activating the worst of society.
Oh my God.
Yeah, this is a continuation.
And good evening, everybody. Welcome to another exciting episode of It's Complicated, an hour of Prague and Prague-adjacent music. We come to you every Monday evening at 7 p.m. between the hours of 7 and 8 here on the East Coast. Your local time may vary. And thanks for joining me. We're going to start tonight's show with some Italian music. And what we're going to hear is a group called Cervello, or I guess Cervello would be the pronunciation, C-E-R-V-E-L-L-O. They are an Italian band, as I mentioned, active in the early 70s. I think I've played them before, but that's okay. That's no obstacle. And we're going to hear a track from a self-titled, oh, no, it's not a self-titled, the album Milos, M-E-L-O-S, released in 1973. And this is an interesting piece. It goes through all the various Prague modes, quite loud, quiet, acoustic. Anyway, this is the Italian group Cervello.
di volti, sorrisi di dolci creature, vestali di fuoco, ambrosie pure che oramai son solo fumo. Percossi dal tempo rincorrono ancora la vita, satiri vanagloriosi si gonfiano viscidi fino a scoppiare, rincorse vane che troveranno solo buio. Cercherà di raccontar la propria storia, ma in van. Crollo di un tempio sarà. We'll be right back.